The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, and it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for the day as we have a conversation with Dr. Suzanne Lockhart, who's no stranger to Guardian Radio, and we're going to be talking some general health today. And I have some questions. Producer, you're going to find out what I'm doing. Me? Something mechanical on you, actually, Doctor.
Me? Is it this?
Let's see if that's that. The headphones.
I need to take them off.
Put it on the air again. Okay. Is that better? Okay, good. Excellent. And we're going to talk some general health, and I have some questions for you, Dr. Lockhart. And the first question I have for you... No. Let me slow it down. Let's talk credentials. Who are you, and what do you specialize in? And then from there, I'll ask my question. New, strange viruses going around that is plaguing our children, and talk about this. We call it this breeding type thing. And it seems like it's a flu. So I want to talk about that and some ideas on how to treat it, what parents should be looking at and looking for. So that's what we're going to start with. But let's start off with you.
Well, I am just so happy to be here with you this morning. Mr. New, you have so much energy. You must have had your papaya shot with your ginger and celery this morning. That's all I could think.
I would say I had Coke soda, but my doctor would have been vexed if I actually confessed that. But so, no, I'm good. I'm always energetic like this.
Man, that's great. But, you know, as you said, I'm no stranger. But it's the first time I've actually come in studio. Before, I was with your colleague and my good friend, Ms. Nahaja Black. But
yes.
Always, because of the time, I was is at a distant feed, you know, with a call or so.
Okay.
But I've been here. My name is Dr. Susan Williams Lockhart, actually. Mm-hmm. Right, I married my late husband, Mr. Lockhart, some 20 years ago. And I've been here in the Bahamas some nearly 30 years. I love it. You know, I can't believe it's been that period of time. But I came here as a baby doctor to do my internship at the Princess Margaret Hospital. And from there, I went and I spent about 5 years in the UK, Scotland, England, Ireland, doing surgery. You know, that's what I did. And I am one of the few women, and am I the only one, but I was one of the few women in the English-speaking Caribbean, and certainly I think maybe the third woman here, to have the distinction of being a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, Scotland.
Nice.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So the girls are still here. I would like to say that we need to do more, and I'm in the process. I mentor and train some of the young doctors, especially some of the female surgeons, and I tell them, you so can do it, go out there and kick butt. I mean, the guys still haven't quite gotten accustomed to the idea that, you know, the women are here in that capacity. We don't have a female general surgeon, and this is Breast Cancer Month. And I would love to say, with great respect to all the, you know, the good men and the physicians and everyone who has put work into that field. But having a female doctor who deals with that, I think, is the same thing like how some women, so, you know, they would rather have a female gynae because mm-hmm. then she understands and knows. Not all the time. But I certainly think that that sort of balance would definitely help. So that's one of the things that, before I come off the scene, you know, to do some other things that I'm working hard to make sure that we can ensure to have. But I spent 5 years in the UK, you know, and that was a whole system. That was at the time, it's funny, because that was the time when they were getting into the European Union, now they're Brexiting. And after that, I returned back to the Bahamas, where I took up the position as lecturer in the University of the West Indies in undergraduate surgery. And that was a small, very embattled program at that time. I worked with such great people as the late Dr. Tony Regis, who was my colleague in anesthesia. And coming from that, I'm very proud of that time because many of the consultants, and both medical, pediatric, surgical. They were my students. And up to now, I still talk to them. And they still tell me, you know, Dr. Lockhart, you know, we thank you for what you did and how you fought for us. Because you don't get to be a surgeon and a woman in a man's field when you don't fight a little bit. Huh? Mm-hmm. You know, I think I would want to say I've learned to fight a little wiser.
So maybe. You're feisty.
Boy, people might say I was bigoted. I think that's the Arian word for it. But you have to kind of be, you know, because you have to believe in yourself and what you're doing. You have to sometimes go out there, fight for your patients, and just fight to make sure that your craft and profession develops in the way that you think it should. It hasn't always done that elsewhere and in the Bahamas as well, too. But I want to think that we are changing and seeing a new and a different day coming along that way. And from there, I left and I went to the islands and I set up a clinic in Andros Island, which my late husband, that was his mother's hometown. And we were there for 3 years and everybody thought we were kind of a little crazy to have done that. But it was a beautiful experience. My children, you know, had experiences of going crabbing, seeing cotton grow. I'm a city girl, so I thought cotton came off from the tree. Mm-hmm. So I was asking the people, I said, well, what is the watermelon doing on the porch and why is the cotton on the bush? And mm-hmm. the people were looking at me a little strange. Isn't she a doctor? And I said, I have never seen it before, apart from in a food store. So it was a great time, those 3 years that we spent in Andros Island, you know, teaching people and augmenting and elevating the level of medical provision there. And still, medicine provision in the Family Islands is something that I love. And I'm talking to the people at the ministry about and on as well, too, because it's so important. And from there, we spent a bit of time. We went to the U.S. where I taught. I was a professor in a couple, 3 or 4 different colleges. I still am an adjunct in the field of medical and health sciences as well. And then back here to the Bahamas, where essentially I went back into hospital medicine, not into surgery per se, but into ambulatory care, working as a resident medical physician in one of the institutions that we have here. And then when the call to COVID, overwhelming need out on the field. And in that way, last year, my husband, Laverne, who was, you know, I call him a Bahamian patriot, you know, he was my Mr. Sunshine. And he worked with me, he wasn't medical, but he was my administrator. And at the time, because of just the need for hands, he came into me on the field. Mm-hmm. And through exhaustion and through just, you know, trying to being overwhelmed, we both got ill with Delta COVID. Mm-hmm. And I managed to fight it through with the help of some good people. Unfortunately, he did not. But I say, unfortunately, he died home. And I always say that God has a plan, you know. So while I grieve that, and my kids, we have 3 beautiful kids. My son, Prince, wants to become a surgeon as well. So I'm happy that he will take up that bastion and carry it forward. And so for my 3 kids, it was difficult. But I think going through something like that, I think gives one a lot of empathy, you know, especially for people who may have suffered the same thing. I have a patient who lost 10 of her family members, you know, and I would talk to her. I say, how do you, what do you do? She says, well, doc, is only God, you know, because when your mother, your aunt, your cousin, your sister, you know, your godfather, three uncles, you know, pass as a result of that. And I think, you know, we're going to talk about that today, but more important than COVID is something that is evolving. But also, I think there's a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder or many issues that were created as a result of that and what we went through as a nation. And certainly that's not something that is easily going to be passed over. People still have to account for that and make sure that they know how they can keep themselves healthy, not just physically, but mentally. It's as much a mind game as anything else, moving forward into this new dispensation or into this new dimension that we have right now. You know, so in a nutshell, I guess that's myself. So many of my friends looked at me, they say, you went where? What you went to do? Why are you doing that? My thing is, you know, and even some people were telling me, they said, you know, were you wise to have done what you did, Susan? You know, jump into the field like that. And my response didn't say I would treat disease A and not disease B. You know, it's whatever was ill and wherever the need was, that's what you were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a slightly different practice now as a single person recuperating myself from long COVID, you know. And but I think that at the end of the day, I don't think there's a whole heap that I would necessarily have changed, except maybe have rested more and made sure that, you know, as a physician, you had your armor on first going forward, you know.
And I would like to commend you and thank you for your dedication to the Bahamas, first of all. And I want to also extend condolences, because I remember when Nahasha told me that your husband has passed, even when she told me that you were sick with COVID. And I said, no, you mean your COVID doctor who comes on with you, who gives you advice? He said, yeah, you know, while she is on the front line, you and your husband were on the front line, and he had actually succumbed. So I wanted to say condolences for that. And he's a true patriot for the Bahamas. And I wanted to talk about this new virus, which there has been a report by the Ministry of Health, right? It's saying that it has respiratory issues, especially attacking young children, right? And I wonder, I say, boy, they're back in school full time. Is this another variation of COVID, or is this the flu season? And what exactly should we be doing as parents? Because my children came home with a strange coughing the other week, right? And eventually the entire house got it, where we were coughing and it pains us. Pained us when you start coughing, right? And I took them to the clinic. You know, they actually had insurance. I'm glad to say that, because it's an expensive thing. But I want to know, what can parents do? What do parents need to look out for regarding this new, or this virus that's going on now?
Well, you know, I think we have to remember that this is the cough and cold season.
Right? Yes.
We're getting into, you know, we woke up this morning, if you notice, just being in the car, it's not, we're having a shift away from the heat of the summer going into the fall season right now. And at fall, viruses are seasonal, huh? They mm-hmm. are. You know, so, you know, in summer, there are certain things that you're going to have. And, you know, in fall, you're going to have, fall going into winter, you're going to have that predominance and that upsurge of, you know, what we call the quote-unquote flu viruses.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, COVID is really a coronavirus, which is basically a very weaponized, a very lethal form of a virus, a coronavirus. That's caused the common cold.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it was at the end of the time. So although it may not be COVID as such, or it may be a different strain or form of it that they may turn around and say at some point in time, you know, because, again, when viruses tend to mutate, and sometimes viruses meet together and they combine. So you might have a red and a blue one meeting together and they become purple,
mm-hmm.
which is probably the best way I could say when you're talking about the different strains of how COVID would tend to mutate. And so when it mutates, the testing and the treatment, okay, for it may be a little bit different. But I think the basic strategies that we have used always are those that hold through, right? So the first thing is you have to make sure that your immunity is good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you ensure that? So first of all, especially if you're talking about kids, and I mean, I'm not a pediatrician, so I'm just going to talk generally here. If you're talking about kids, you make sure that they have enough rest, that they eat a diet that is, you know, full of as many organic and what we call ground foods as is possible,
mm-hmm.
not as much processed foods. I know that sometimes it's difficult.
That's hard.
Yeah, because, you know, they want the things that they want. They like the sugar and the bright packages and other things like that. But you got to find a way. I had a friend who used to put it in smoothies with ice cream with them, or, you know, make cookies and, you know, in the chocolate she'd put some, you know, beetroot and so.
So ground food is important.
Yeah, so natural stuff, because in the natural part of it is that the vitamins and minerals that you need for your system is really and truly a lot of that is found in the food that we are eating that is natural.
Mm-hmm.
So the colored stuff. I always say to people, you want to eat the rainbow, certainly. Because
mm-hmm.
when you eat the rainbow, plants have in them a lot of natural antioxidants, anti-inflammatories. They have compounds such as flavonoids, steroids, anthocyanins, which are all important in terms of fighting, helping you to boost your immune system and to allow it also to fight against any sort of invader. Certainly, so first of all, the first thing is you want to make sure that, you know, you present as good a front as possible. Dish something simple, for instance, instead of maybe juice and soda, water, right?
Drink water.
Yeah, water. Make sure that they have, you know, the fruit juices. You know, we have lemonades and we have lemons, and lemon is a fantastic source of vitamin C as well. So as much as is possible, you want to try to get them to do those things. Also make it important that children go outside and play in the sunshine, you know. One of the things is most kids like to stay on the phone or the devices all the time, you know. I remember once passing through a neighborhood, I saw all the trees were laden with, I think it was either plums or something like that. And I say, but where are the children? How come the tree? They say, the children don't go outside and play, it's too hot.
Mm.
Mommy, we're staying in with our, you know, our Game Boy or PS4 or whatever the devices that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
But when kids go outside to play, two things happen. Number one, they're outside in the fresh air, which is great for them. That's oxygen,
mm-hmm.
right? That fresh air and wind blowing tends to blow any pathogens and so that you have. And number two, when they're out in the sunshine, remember sunshine also helps them build vitamin D in the skin, build up their vitamin D
mm-hmm.
levels as well. So it's the second thing. And the third thing is when you're outside, you sort of like get exposed to germs and other things that are there, and you can build and boost your immunity naturally, right? So those are some things. And when kids don't play, and playing outside, you get, you know, you exercise your muscles, you get strong, you get strength from that perspective. So that's a very good thing to be able to do, yeah?
So I was taking notes, you know, because I get tell my wife what we got to do. You say rest, right?
Yeah.
You need to drink water.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get fruit juices. You need to get that sunlight and that vitamin D.
Yes.
You need to do outside activities. You need fresh air, and you need to boost your immunity.
Yes, immunity, and as much as you can, eat things. I mean, and listen, sometimes, I never forgot one time I was at the food store down south, and I went to get some packaged broccoli or something, and a man came, he said, "You are Dr. Lockhart, you can't be using prepackaged food." I was like, "Mister, I have 3 children home, right? Time as I get ready to chop this up and cut this up, they'll be hungry or they wouldn't want to eat." But as much as you possibly can, you want to use things that are freshly prepared. You see what I'm saying to you? Mm-hmm. So whatever the ratio of it for you, I tell people, everybody knows their situation, right? Some of us can do that more, some of us can do it less. But however you can, if you have an option or alternative, try to utilize that. That's the thing you want to do. And then after that, you know, the basic common courtesies, you know, and especially now, we make sure we sanitize your hands. You make sure, I think in some schools or in most schools, they're still using the mask. Mm-hmm. But really, the mask is a way to cover your mouth and your nose. So yes. If you're coughing or sneezing, you know, you do a cough covering with that is what you do. You know, you put it in or go away from people when you're in that situation as well. And I mean, kids are going to be kids, you know. They are going to hug and kiss, share food, do all those other things. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, boy, how to put it? To put that carefully, that's not necessarily a bad thing because that's the way you build immunity. You know, normally, you know, I never forgot years ago, this is about 20, 25 years ago, and I think it was my niece or one of my little cousins or something like that. She had either a cold or something, and she was going, and then the lady was going to keep her away, and then the lady in the daycare said, no, she's not bad. If I come, let all of them get it, let them be miserable
and
one time.
And you know that most schools now say if you have a little cough or you have a little flu, you stay home.
Yeah, so it's a different, and I can't blame them. You know, I'm just saying how we have had to shift because if you have a child who has an altered immune system or reduced immune system, they may not be able to withstand that. And then next thing it is, you have a situation where it is, you know, it's untenable. In some cases, it could be, you know, still somebody, COVID is still there. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want that being passed around. But what I'm saying is that part and parcel of the kids coming out and kids not staying in and being locked away and everything else like that is also that they build their immunity by being exposed, you know, because you could get immunity. So for instance, you can get immunity by giving the kids things, the antibodies. You know, that's one way that you, or you can let their own immune system develop it when they fight it as well. Because what they found was in some places, it was that some places had what you call a zero COVID policy. And I think I refer here particularly to maybe New Zealand and maybe I think Japan, where they won't. So, but what happened? So nobody was there. It was fine. But then when they opened the borders up, what happened? Their people's immune system were not accustomed to fighting it. So then they had a whole new swath of things coming through. So there's a balance between the two, I think. And I think it's just about, you know, being sensible with that as well, I believe, you know.
And for lack of a better word, there are people who will call you a COVID expert, a local COVID expert, right? Just because of your studies and you're watching and you found out things to treat COVID in general. And you mentioned that you suffered from lung COVID. The question I want to ask you is, long-term effects from COVID, what should we be looking for to say, well, this is different. I don't feel the same since I've had COVID. And then to get treatment?
Well, you know, the thing about it is that I think here in the Bahamas and other societies where we have a working public, working capital, you basically get up and do what you need to do regardless of how you tend to feel, you know. Maybe in places like maybe the US and the UK, you know, where people may be a little bit more sensitive and there may be a little more of a social net, especially where you have that socialized medicine, so to speak, people may say, okay, I don't, and what's it, and let me check it and see. But essentially, what happens is that after COVID, if after you have some 12 weeks and you're still finding you have a certain category of symptoms. So, for instance, it may mean that you have what people talk about as the brain fog. Brain fogginess, where you know, okay, you know the name of something, like that's a red bag. I know that's a bag. I know it's red, but I'm struggling to see what it is. Or I see someone I know very well, and I can't remember the name to see it at that particular point in time. So there's this brain fog, they call it brain fogginess, where it's difficult to really, you know, think straight. Some people get very fatigued. They get extremely fatigued, they get very tired, they're not able to function. You know, they may be able to get up in the morning, but by 10, 12 o'clock, they have to wipe out, they have to go, you know, sit. There's nothing more that they can do. Some people have, especially those who had lung pathology and lung symptomatology, they have recurrence of shortness of breath and difficulty and shortness of breath, especially when you're trying to do something. So they have to build back up that exercise tolerance and ability gradually over a period of time. Some of the other things that you may have, some people may have nausea, they may have dizziness, They may just not feel well, you know. So all of these things, when you have it and you're not able to function. So, you know, people sometimes say, well, how do you prove that? How do you prove it, or how do you disprove that at the end of the time? Well, there are some blood tests which may suggest it, right? One of the things that they were finding is that because COVID does such a number on the immune system, that some things and some viruses which your immune system would have previously been able to handle, those have resurged once again. So things like Epstein-Barr virus is one of those viruses that, you know, many people have it. It's a herpes type virus. But normally with a good working immune system, it's going to basically keep it down under. But many people who have COVID, and especially long-haul COVID, it reactivates itself. And it can cause them symptoms and issues and problems at the end of the time. Mm-hmm. You see? So there's the thing. Now, in bigger societies like in the US and in the UK particularly, they were finding so many people were not able to 42, which is about maybe 2.5%, right, of people. And maybe up to, 30% of those were people who could not go back out to work. These were young, healthy people, you know, people between their 20s and 40s. And they were not able to, they had to either go on long-term disability because of these symptoms that I'm talking about at the end of the time. And we are seeing that, I think, is probably the next thing that we're going to have happening here. Mm. And maybe it is there to a certain extent. But I think in the Bahamas, most people, especially after the downturn of the economy, they are not going to really want to say, okay, I can't do it, or, you know, I'm not able to make it. Sometimes you don't have a choice. You got to get up and you got to work anyway. So they may sort of soldier through and push on with it. But certainly myself and some of my colleagues who, you know, some of my colleagues have asked me to say, you know, what about this person who had it? They're still having symptoms. And we started looking at it. And certainly we are seeing there's an uptick in people who have had it. Now, excuse me, who is more likely to get it? Now, from what they're saying is if you've been hospitalized, if you've had more than 5 symptoms of COVID, if you're a woman, especially if you're over the age of, 45, 50, and if you've had some sort of predisposing factor like hypertension, diabetes. Mm-hmm. So for myself, I tick several of those boxes at the end of the time going on. You know, but I think, thankfully, I think through, you know, good practices and other things like that, I think I've more or less, I'm moving and able to go back out. But I know this has been like a year from when I first began, you know, when I first got ill. Mm-hmm. And I know if you ask me in December, oh my goodness, I was like, I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember going to the US and having to drive and just being totally wiped out by driving a short distance. And I was like, whoa, what's happening? You know, some of the people that maybe you may have palpitations. So some people actually feel, you know, they've gotten COVID once again. They say, mm-hmm. Oh my God, these are the same symptoms. But when they go test, they're testing negatively for it at the point in time. You see?
Okay. I'm speaking to actually Dr. Suzanne William Lockhart. And we have a general health conversation. We have a caller on the line who wants to engage her. Producer, you patch that caller through. Go ahead, caller. And the caller's gone there. So we continue this the conversation, Dr. Lockhart. In terms of the booster shot, you know, I've just been diagnosed with diabetes, right? I just found out. I didn't know all this time that I'm diabetic, right? And so now I'm one of those predisposed persons, right, who have an ailment, a lingering ailment. Should I be the one to say, hey, I need to take this booster shot for sure? Because I know I'm trying to stay away from these artificial things, right? I know I diet and exercise, you know, and trying to eat well. And looking at this booster shot, and they say, boy, you are one of those people who should be taking it.
You know, well, what I always tell people, you know, and people, you know, on both sides of the divide, they come up and they say, no, you know, you're waffling, you're watching, you're not saying it one way or the other. But I tell them, I say, listen, I work for myself in what I do at this particular point in time. And the way I see it is, like I told people, I said, look here, the vaccine was neither an angel nor was it a demon. Mm-hmm. Okay, the vaccine was basically a therapeutic strategy, which was at that point in time created because we had a public health emergency that therefore unknown proportions that we had to do it. So, but like any other therapy, there are some good things that you will have with it, and there are some not so good things that you have with it. There's a side effect to everything. I mean, there's a tablet that we take all the time. It can kill you if you take it on the age of 12. It can cause you to have bleeding, ulcers, and allergic reactions that could put you in hospital and kill you. It's called aspirin, right?
Yeah.
So there is nothing. There is no therapeutic regime or therapeutic substance which you're going to use, even vitamins, which are quote-unquote natural. And if you eat 100 carrots, you're probably going to end up having some issues and problems. Yes. So it all has to do with that balance. And what I tell people is this, I said that you have to sit and look at yourself, look at your lifestyle, speak with your healthcare provider, the best thing for me moving forward. What are the pros of this? What are the cons of it? What is it that my family as a whole is going to go ahead and move forward doing? right? And I think people now have a little bit more choices because so many things have been relaxed. You know, before it was like you had to have it. But now, you know, that is a bit now more on the relaxed side. But I would say that because, you know, I would say that to it, the vaccine itself is not a one-shot build-all. The vaccine is not a Kevlar vest, is what I always tell people. The vaccine is a workman that uses the building blocks that you have to build a higher wall for any pathogen to climb over. So if you're when you have two blocks, right, to begin with, that's all it has to use, basically. And your wall may not be as strong as somebody else's who, you know, may have had 15 or 20 blocks, somebody who did not have predisposing conditions to continue to go on with, you see?
Okay, and I see the caller's calling back again. So producer, pass the caller through. Let's see if they can hear us now. You turn on your radio there, caller. You can go ahead.
You hear me now?
I can hear you, clearly.
Yeah. Tell me this. We have so much of these. A lot of people growing a lot of stuff in the yard. Like, we have the moringa tree. We have the life tree. Mm. All of them deals with the respiratory system and vitamins and everything and all that. Why you don't really push that so much, you know? And the people, them have, some people have it in the yard and they don't use them.
Mm. You know, good morning, caller. This is Dr. Lockhart here, and I am in full agreement with you. Now, the only thing what I tell people is that any supplement that you're using, even if it is a natural supplement, is something that affects your metabolism. You still have to be aware of it, and, you know, with any other condition and medication that you may be taking, and you should still talk about that with your, you know, your healthcare provider. Because the things in the moringa, and moringa is a good, is used in several preparations or presentation preparations. The one thing about it is that when you are talking about making a therapeutic substance, you put a cup in it to boil it. I may put two, somebody else puts 2.5. So there's no known sort of quote-unquote dose regime. Sometimes the old people will tell you, you boil it with this and that together, so one combats the next. Some people will tell you, don't boil it, just steep it in the water. So it may not necessarily be as concentrated from that point of view. But having said that, I think, sir, that there are a lot of things that you have. I think we've lost a lot of those old craft and folk wisdom. You know, my grandmother herself, she was a folk healer, and she used to take me when I was 16 and very rude out in the garden with her. I didn't want to be out in the garden with no lady. So I didn't listen to what she was telling me about many of the plants and herbs. And I'm now discovering it and saying, boy, my grandmother was such a wealth of knowledge, you know, going back some 40 years ago. So, yes, I think that certainly there are some things in the garden. There are certain things that we can grow, you know, lemon, the sage bushes, the green onions, and other things which are good for several situations. Green stuff is typically tends to be good for the health of the cells in the body overall and helps them to repair when you have any sort of damages. So those are some of the things that, yes, they are good. And if we ate more stuff from the ground, and we planted more things. First of all, one, green trees produce oxygen, which we all need. And if we planted more things, getting them out of the ground itself as well, we would probably have a better profile in terms of the minerals and the supplementation that we need. So I think that's a good idea to do. It is, definitely.
Dr. Lockhart, this October is Breast Cancer Awareness, right? And a number of women in the Bahamas have found themselves plagued with this issue. And I have a distant cousin, a man, who actually died, succumbed to breast cancer. Mm-hmm. I was a Bahamian guy. And I want to know, like, what are the signs? What should women look for in terms of, or what should they do to make sure that they don't become a victim? Well, especially, you know, let me just change it. Men. I mean, even though I know it's a women's issue, right? And because I had that one cousin, we never thought about him checking his breasts to feel any lump, you know, and perhaps that's the reason why he succumbed to it.
Well, you know, but most people do, and especially for men, if you talk, we talk about the men and go on to the women, but in the case of the men, you know, as I said, I saw there was a very good article, I think, one of the surgical oncologists, younger surgical oncologist, Dr. Major, I think that was in one of the papers yesterday. Hopefully it was yours, maybe.
Go ahead.
but what he said, you know, men, 1 in 250 chances of them developing that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about it is that when a person is, you know, showering or taking a bath or anything like that, if there's a lump or changing their clothes, ideally speaking, you should be able to feel it. See, don't feel up yourself.
No, just in case. While you're here, might as well check just in case, you know.
Listen, he have all his clothes on. Right? Yeah. Let's just get that.
No clothes on.
Right. But you have to do it. You have to be able to look at that and see. And also, if it's a man, he has to look at his family history if he does know it. Does he have many what you call first-degree relatives? That is his mom, his aunts, his sisters with breast cancer. Does he have a family history of either prostate cancer or pancreatic cancer? Because there are sometimes breast cancer is genetic. And in the Bahamas right now, and this was an amazing thing, but it was discovered that we have the highest proportion of breast cancer patients who have a genetic predisposition. It's 25% of the cancer patients have a genetic predisposition for either having a mutation of a particular gene that helps the cells repair themselves when the gene works, yes? The gene is just something that gives the cell instructions, yes? So right order, the cell can repair itself properly and it does not become cancerous. But when you have a mutation where it does not work properly, then you end up having cancer. And they found that up to 25% of the women who had been diagnosed as breast cancer in the Bahamas had this particular genetic malfunction. And so as a result of that, we tend to get cancer at a younger age. The average age of breast cancer being discovered is 42 years of age.
That's young, eh?
Yeah, it's 62 in the U.S. These are figures I'm reading. It's from the Susan Komen study that was done. They're an NGO that worked, you know, with the Bahamas, with the runs, and with getting mammography and other things like that to people. And the average age at which over 50% of the women may pass is at, under 50, 43% of them may pass under age 50. And when women get breast cancer in the Bahamas, it tends to happen at a younger age. They have a more advanced age, and then it's a more aggressive type disease, you see? So I always remember Dr. Larry Carroll, who was the radiologist at Doctors Hospital for a very long time. He would always say, many years ago, even before it was shown on studies that, you know, the breast cancer in the Bahamas is a different type of cancer. The Bahamian breast is a different type of breast. And some people took him, and other people said, that's just him too. But he was proven to be correct. I think it was maybe between 2002 to 2011, out of the Miller School of Medicine, she noted that many of her Bahamian patients were so young. And when she talked to her other colleagues, they said, yeah, we're seeing women, you know, in under 30, under 40, you know, what's happening? And so they sat down and they did their study, and those were one of the things that they found. Right, that the cancer gene is the BRCA1, they call it normally BRCA1 and BRCA2. And mm-hmm. they said that up to 25% of the women, you know, had that. And that gives you a worse prognosis. It increases your risk of cancer. And, you know, as I said, we have to therefore be very vigilant about that. So I think the first thing is, you know, I know October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but I tell people, I say, when you talk about your breasts, it's always like breast and cancer. Women have breasts. You have breasts from since you in utero, mm-hmm. right? You're going to have breasts. And so every day, although, you know, every month, all 12 months of the year, you have breast, and you should be aware of your breast health and your breast awareness. The first thing about it is you have to be, what's your risk factors like? You know, that's the first thing I would think that you want to look at, even whether you're a man. So do you have a family history, as I said, of breast cancer, family history of ovarian, family history of prostate or pancreatic cancer? Those four are sort of like they tend to ride together. There are some islands that they say anecdotally, places like Andros and in Elutra, where you have what you call cancer families. I know of one or two where every woman in the family had either breast or ovarian cancer. I have a friend who is like that. She's out of Trinidad, not in the Bahamas, too. So they have some. So when that happens and the, you know, lightning doesn't strike twice, three, four, five times, unless there is some sort of, there's a genetic sort of predisposition towards it as well, too, right? There are certain types of before, certain type of lumps which show certain changes, again, that may increase your risk. If you're overweight, especially when you're heading into the postmenopausal ages, because breast cancers are driven by estrogen dependent in many cases, and when you have more fat, you have a higher level of estrogen associated with those cells. So that's one of the things. People who drink alcohol, you know, you want to not do that as much. Some, especially in the postmenopausal ages, some hormonal supplementations, especially if they're estrogen-related, again, those are things that you may not want to do. One very important thing, and it's simple, exercise, you know. It should not, if you exercise, you reduce your risk of getting cancer or recurring it once again tremendously also, right? So those are some of the basic things that you can do no matter what it may be. And we just have to be more aware of it. There's still a lot of fear. When I did it, I was talking with another group the other day, and a woman came up to me. She said, you know, my mommy just got diagnosed. She felt a lump maybe 2 years ago, and she was scared, and now she just went and, you know. And then her thing was, well, you know, I don't really know. And I was asking her, I said, you also have to be careful now if that's happened to your mom. What are you? She said, you know, they don't really tell you anything until you're not sure. And there's this sort of cloak of secrecy, maybe this cloak of shame, maybe this cloak of, you know, if I get cancer and I have to take off my breasts, I'm no longer a woman, I will not be attractive. There are so many. And I think we have moved past that point. You know, we really and truly have moved past that point. And, you know, there are many good organizations. There are sister breast organizations. There are many good surgeons who for years, you know, there's Dr. Monroe, Dr. Diggins, they would have two ones who founded the sister breast cancer organization, and many people who have done work in that field for many years. But it would be good to have a more cohesive strategy because we deal with things here as well as, you know, many people go over to the U.S., for their treatment rather than staying in this area. But it's just something I think we have to be aware of and that we pay good attention to as well.
And I'm talking general health, and right now we're talking about breast cancer. And we're going to take a short break, but after the break, this is what I want to talk about, right? In your practice, and you come across one of your patients with breast cancer, I want to know what's the steps, what happens then, right? Just so if persons are mentally dealing with it, right, and too afraid to take that next step and say, okay, I'm going to the doctor, but I feel this lump. What can they anticipate what will happen? So that's what I want you to talk about when you come on the next side of the break. This is Guardian Radio in AM with C.A. Nuri, and we'll be right back.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Here we go. J.S. Johnson Insurance agents are the best. Reliable service, we've been on the scene, protecting since 1919. J.S. Johnson Insurance has the best, always. You're always covering me. J.S. Johnson Insurance, peace of mind.
And welcome back to Guardian Radio in the AM with Dr. Slim Lockhart, and we're talking general health, and we're talking about breast cancer at this present time since it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I want to know the process. I want to know the process of you feel a lump in your breast. You have a little bit of anxiety, right? But you know that it's serious enough that you need to go to the, get check out, right? Get a doctor visit. But you want to know, like, what all will happen. Mm-hmm. What typically happens when someone comes to you and I guess you physically do the exam and you confirm there's a lump?
So now it depends upon... So the first thing is, you know, you want to tell, be able to say to the person, okay, so what is that? What might that potentially be? So in a lot of cases, it depends upon the history of the person's, what's your family history like, what's your own medical history like? You know, have you had a lump in the breast before? You know, because lumps in the breast, not all lumps are necessarily cancerous lumps. You see what I'm saying? Sometimes a lumps could be a cyst. It could be a tumor that is there but is benign. A lump in the breast of a 16-year-old person is very different to a lump in the breast of a 46 or 56-year-old person. You know, you're thinking about a different spectrum of disorders there and a different type of diagnosis. A lump in the breast of a person who has no risk factors for breast cancer at 40 is very different from the lump in the breast of a woman who may have had a story where her aunts, her sisters, her mother all had breast cancer, the father had colon cancer, cousin may have had pancreatic cancer. So again, a lot depends upon the history and the specifics and of the patient themselves. You see, that's the first thing that you have to understand. And then, so the other thing is you feel one lump, and you need to get to a healthcare practitioner. In our setting, it's primarily the physicians.
Mm-hmm.
But in many settings, like in the U.S. and the U.K., we have nurses who could do it. And I think our nurses probably, you know, with that level function, hopefully that will change soon. And they need to do a thorough examination, because you may have another lump in some of the parts, maybe on the other breast, maybe underneath the arm, we call that the axilla, or in the glands or the nodes that drain the breast. Because breast tissue is not just in the chest, you know. Breast tissue can go all the way above the collarbone, all the way to the bottom part of the, just above the rib cage, right? The breast tissue can go. And up into the, there's a part of the breast tissue that falls under the muscle, the pectoralis muscle as well, you know. So there's a, so you need to feel and make sure that, you know, there's no other lump that you can find or can see therein, right? And then after that, they have to do some sort of definitive thing. So are you going to go forward to doing a biopsy at that point in time, right?
What's a biopsy exactly?
So biopsy, just taking a specimen or sampling of the tissue so that you can test the cells and see what it is. So depending upon, is it a big lump? Is it a smaller lump that you're going to, you know, either do a needle, or you're going to take a core of the cells, or you're going to try to take it out completely to do that particular testing as well, right? And that gives you an idea as to what it may be.
How expensive that is?
Boy, I can't tell you.
No ballpark figure?
Well, I mean, if you're going to do something like that, if you have insurance, then you're okay. Now, everybody may charge a different rate at the end of the time period, but you may be looking at maybe a couple hundred to get that first, you know, that first, and depending upon the type of biopsy that you're going to do. And in most cases, either pre-biopsy or post. And it may be a good idea to do it before, because you want to see if there's any other areas. It may not just be one, it could be one, but it could be something else that you have therein as well, too. So then they would send you for a mammogram to be done, mammography, right?
And that's different from the biopsy thing.
Yeah, the mammography is when you're going into, so now you're looking at sonography, means to, you know, to look at. Mammo refers to breast. So this is to look at the tissues. It's like a special x-ray of the breast then. And there are different types, and we do have a spectrum of different machines, I think, here in Nassau. And thankfully, you have quite a few in Nassau. Now, in the Family Islands, it's not as good a spectrum, obviously, so people have to travel and come up here. But essentially, what they will do is they will tend to compress that breast tissue, and they will look at it, and there are certain things you're looking for. So if you have a lump, well, a lump is there already, but they can look and see if in that lump, they're often able to tell if there's any sort of characteristics which may tell them to think that there's cancer. So look, you look for things like microcalcifications or calcifications therein. And then you may also look for other areas of the breast, because you really want to discover a cancerous or a malignant focus of tissue before it actually gets to the stage of a lump, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the bigger it gets, then it's maybe more likely that there could have been spread in some way or some situation, right? So you want to hopefully see it. The hope is, and that's why they tell you mammography is a screening tool where hopefully you will pick up things at an early stage so that the treatment and the prognosis is going to be better, right? But that's the thing that you would do. And then, according to what they find...
You know, I can pause and say, how much does a mammogram thing cost now?
Well, for the breast cancer month, I think I really commend the providers. They've done very well. I'm not going to say anyone in particular, but I think under $100,
okay,
between 40, 50 to 100, a little over, you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell most ladies, you know, that's something you should certainly do, because, I mean, if you talk about going to the hairdresser, I know mm-hmm. the basic thing is $60 to $70. You're mm-hmm. talking about maybe a trip or two to get it done. And people used to be afraid in the past that, it would spread the cancer, or it mm-hmm. would press your breast down. No, it doesn't do any of those things, right? It's just a way to see if you actually have an area that they can be concerned about, and, you know, you can therefore treat that the best way that you can.
So biopsy, after that?
I mean, mammogram biopsy, depending upon what the particulars of it are. And then you would have an answer back. You'd mm-hmm. have an answer back as, okay,
that... How long does that take?
Well, if you're talking about a biopsy, it depends upon how you rush it. But I would think within 2 weeks.
2 weeks,
right?
Get an answer.
You'd be able to have it with the mammograms. You can get the answer back within a few days or the same day. You know, if sometimes depending upon how closely related to the physician is to, you know, if it's a physician that works in the same place where mm-hmm. the mammogram is taking place, you can have an answer back fairly quickly in that way. And then after that point in time, now you come up with, okay, what's your plan for treatment? What's your treatment plan? So then you have to look and see, depending upon what it is. So if it is something that is, you know, a malignant situation where it looks concerning, so then the next thing is, okay, what's the next step in terms of your therapeutic options?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're looking and looking to that, the first thing you have to see is, okay, is that this the only place where this this problem is, or has it gone anywhere else? We mm-hmm. talk about you wanting to stage it and see, is it there? Has it moved? It depends upon the size of it. The bigger a lump is at presentation, the more likely it may be that some of those cancer cells have jumped in the bloodstream or jumped in the lymphatic fluid and moved. So you want to do, there are some ways you can do that. You know, there are some different scans you can look at, some MRIs, maybe PET scans. It all depends upon what the particulars are. So you want to stage that.
So you could do an MRI to test the blood in general?
No, not testing the blood. You're looking to see if there are any other... so an MRI, some cases where you're not certain, or they may have a focus area, or there may be an area in the breast that it is not clear whether or not you have a malignant process there. An MRI can sometimes, you know, make that more clear, but it's not something you will do as a matter of course. You know, okay. That's in a special case. So then you have to go on. You may do ultrasounds. You may do bone scans. You may do a scan called that looks at looking for any sort of focus of a cancerous growth. Cancer cells tend to grow faster, use up more nutrients than other cells, and sometimes you can see that, you know, on a PET scan. So you would do that, then depending upon the symptom profile of the person. Then you come to what is the particular treatment now. Is it that some people are going to say, is it for taking out the lump? Is it taking out the entire breast? Is it taking out both breasts, you know? So a lot depends upon what you have found before. Mm-hmm. And then also, as I said, the person's genetic situation.
History, whatever it is.
History. So as I said, if you have a person who is 16 and fine, that is probably may just be something that's a fibroma or something that is relatively benign. But if you have somebody who's 46 with a history of many people in the family having cancer, that may be something more severe. And go ahead.
No, I remember when I was younger, 10, 11, my mom had a lump in her breast and they did a surgery and removed that lump. And then I have distant cousins, who had one breast completely removed. But their family in general has a history of cancer. She have like a sister and a brother who died of cancer, and then a grandfather who died of cancer, and so on. So they know their family's plagued with it. And I just wanted to know, basically, lost my train of thought, what should be happening now, the conversation that they should be having with their doctor?
Well, the conversation is, and certainly one of the things we were talking about, this person, this hypothetical patient who may have a lump that they found. And one of the other things, depending upon, my doctor may say, okay, we need to do genetic testing.
Mm-hmm.
And some people may, you know, would recommend that to say, okay, is there, do you have this genetic marker, this mutation, yes or no? Because if you have that, then in some cases they say, okay, listen, having it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have cancer.
Yeah.
Having cancer doesn't necessarily mean that you have it. But if you have cancer and you have that genetic marker, then it may mean that your prognosis and your likelihood of developing cancer may increase.
Well, right? What about mental health? I mean, you telling me I have even a lump in my breast, I'll be devastated. Even if you say, I could take it out and this is not malign, it's just a lump and we'll take it out. I mean, I'm officially a changed person.
Well, I think that's why I said you have to, when you're thinking about doing that, you have to sit down and have to understand with your provider what is happening and what the situation is and what does that actually mean. Not every lump necessarily means that you have cancer. Not every time area where a woman has cancer necessarily means that, okay, you know, she's not going to be around. You know, that's why we say you have to look at, okay, what's the staging of that? How far is that spread? What type of cancer is it? Because each one has a different outlook coming down the pipeline with that. You see what I'm saying?
And I see I have 4 minutes. I'm going to ask this question too. You mentioned the word staging a couple of times, and I don't understand.
Gone. So you have stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four. Stage one means, you know, either you find it when it's not, you can't feel it. When it's very small, stage two, it's a bit bigger, but it's not necessarily gone up to the breast. Stage three, it may have gone to areas that are on the same side of that body. Stage four is when it moves from the breast, it goes to the liver, it goes to the bone, it goes to the brain. And normally people, what they were finding that many people, if they wait late, they're going to be caught at the stage three, stage four. And when mm-hmm. it may have gone to the glands as well, which, you know, puts another component of difficulty there at the end of the day. So the first thing that you do, because then for myself, and to make it clear now, I don't want people coming and saying, well, come on, when are you going to go and cut my breast or whatever it is? I'm not in hospital practice at this time. I do have mobile care. Mm-hmm. But I talk and I advise many people in terms of what needs to happen. We do have competent surgeons both here and both, you know, at a distance peer way. But it's about assessing what is your risk factors. It's about assessing what the risk factors are that you have and then making a decision for you. Some women have opted to have, especially if they have the cancer markers, they've opted to have both breasts taken off. Because they said, you know something, if I don't have breasts, I can't get breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Some women have opted to have both breasts and their ovaries taken away because, again, the ovaries are the estrogen-producing areas and they drive, you know, the estrogen can tend to drive a cancer situation as well, too. That is if they have, especially if they have the genetic markers, if they have the BRCA1 and BRCA2, you see? So it all depends upon what is it that you have. Now, there are other gene mutations, not just BRCA1 and 2, which can cause cancer also. So you, even if you don't have that, but you have a very strong family history, then you need to sit and talk with your provider and say, okay, where are we moving forward? What is it that we need to do? Okay? So this is the thing. But the point about it is a lot of the times, and I commend anybody who, and there's a lot of, as you said, the mental health component of it, you're going to need support. Because a lot of the times, the women see that and they hide it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the time they say, okay, that was there for 6 months, but I was so scared I didn't do anything. No, talk to somebody. Tell, you know, a nurse or a doctor. Tell a friend and say, you know, man, I might need you to come with me to help me do this because I just feel so scared. You know, that happened to my Grammy. And then the next thing I know, Grammy dead or she had one breast. And there are so many different options right now. So many different options for doing that, for doing biopsies, for reconstructing if you have to have that type of surgery. This is not the way it was before, you know.
And I want to save, Amalia, I'm going to invite you back so we can talk more general health. But I want to save the last 2 minutes, basically explaining your practice, that how people can get in contact with you.
Well, I run Capriata Health and Wellness Consultants. You know, this is the company I had with my husband. Basically, you call us or WhatsApp us, 806-0199. You can send me a message, capriatahealthandwellness@gmail.com. That's another way to do it as well, too. We're in process of getting a physical office place, because some people tell me, Doc, man, where I could find you? You know, so I'm like, okay, I'm going to get that and I'm going to set that there. But what I do essentially is that I go to people in their homes, right? Mm-hmm. Or their offices or, you know, the hotel sometimes, depending upon it. People, especially with the advent of COVID, did not want to go to a medical facility. Mm-hmm. So we could bring that to them, right? Mm-hmm. We could bring that to them in whichever way they were doing it. So things like wounds, as we said, breast care and wellness, you know, any sort of, if you need a prescription for something, a physical exam, those are sort of the things that
we do. Give me then your number again.
806-0199.
I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation and definitely invite you back so we can talk about more issues, more viruses, and basically what to talk about and what to do. This has been Guardian Radio in AM with C.A. Nuri, and I was talking to Dr. Suzanne Lockhart. I enjoyed myself. Have a wonderful day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM.